And my mother was also very supportive. I remember she took me to X Factor when I was like 16, and we were just sitting out there for since 6 a.m. waiting for the auditions, and I got through the first and the second, but you've got like 5 or 6 to get through to get to the TV.
That is so cool.
Yeah, so like my entire family was like, okay, she's the singer, she's gonna make it, she's gonna, you know. And so
for many years, thousands of Nepalis have been moving overseas with the hopes of a better education, job, and lifestyle. Some find success in conventional fields, while some carve their own paths. Who is to say one is better than the other? Success is a journey, not a destination. So come on this journey with me, where we connect with our Nepali communities living overseas and explore their conventional and unconventional paths. My name is Sankalpa Gurung, and this is Hamro Yatra. Namaste and welcome to the 31st episode of Hamro Yatra. In today's episode, we are joined by Sneha Shakya Shrestha, the youngest Nepali female barrister in the UK. Sneha was born in Kathmandu, Nepal as an only child for an extended period of time. In this episode, Sneha shares with us the joys and challenges of being the first child in the family and how this has helped shape her personality and the career path she has chosen. Sneha is highly ambitious, confident and diligent. We go over how she got into pursuing law as a career, the challenges and highlights in her field, and the importance of not rushing. I hope this episode helps you to let go of your fears and continue to see the bigger picture in your life. Sneha has also been generous to offer advice to anyone looking to get into law, so feel free to reach out to her. As always, if you enjoy these conversations, please share with your friends and family. Remember to follow our Instagram page at hamro.yatra for updates, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and leave us a 5-star review. You can also financially support us on thisishamroyatra.com/support.
Welcome to Hamro Yatra, Sneha. I'm so glad we could make the time today for the interview.
You're very welcome. I'm looking forward to this.
So we usually start the podcast with a few icebreaker questions. Mm-hmm. Now, the first one being, if you could choose any superpower, what would it be?
The ability to read really, really fast.
How fast are we talking?
I'm talking by a glance.
Wow. So you just like look at a book, a novel, and you're done.
Yeah, photogenic memory. Yeah, totally.
And photogenic memory on top of that.
And that, yeah. No, I think it can come together. It can kind of work together.
Okay, gotcha.
And the reason being, it's very clear because the amount of reading I have to get involved in, it can get very, very tiring. And if you're slow, it slows the whole process down.
Yeah, gotcha. And if you could choose one dish for the rest of your life, what comes to your mind?
Momo. For sure. No competition.
Yep, get that 100%. Now, if you could go back into Nepal's history, mm-hmm. any particular moment in Nepal's history, is there anything, any particular point that you'd like to go back to?
Well, the one sort of anecdote I've always had about my childhood in Nepal is, I don't know if you know, but I used to sing. I used to actually perform in England before, but I've been singing since I was apparently 18 months, my mother says.
Wow.
But there was this time when I was, I think, 4 or 5, and I was skating. Mm. And for some reason I was competing with the adults, being the little one, and I fell over and broke my arm. And all that happened, and I got taken to the hospital by my auntie, and all I was doing at the time was humming a song. I'd broken my arm, my right wrist, I think it was,
yeah.
And all I could think of was to just hum that song that I really, really liked at the time, and it was a really old, it's like it was a ghazal actually, so it was Jaggi, Meri Aankho Ne Chuna Hai. So I was like,
oh my goodness.
And my auntie was just like,
what is wrong with this child?
Exactly. So that's a really vivid memory of how I was when I was a little boy.
So you'd like to go back to that to just see what happened, yeah. To relive that.
I would like to.
Now, could you tell us more about what your childhood was like? Mm-hmm. Tell us about young Sneha.
So I think it would help briefly to give you like an idea of where I kind of fell in my family tree. Mm-hmm. So my mother was the middle child of five, and she was the only one that got married so early because she married when she was 18. And so I was always the only grandchild in the house. Mm-hmm. And on my father's side, they were three sons. It was lawyer, engineer, and doctor, actually.
Wow.
So even in that household, there were sons, but I was the only granddaughter. So it was always like this kind of only granddaughter, grandchild syndrome. Not that I was spoiled or anything, but it was just I was the only one there. So most of the time I got on with adults. And so I matured very, very quickly because I felt like my friends were my aunties and uncles rather than cousins because I was born in Kathmandu. Mm. My mother's from Baglung and dad's from Chowdhara, Sindhu Palzok. So in Kathmandu, I just kind of grew up on my own with the adults. So that was me. I mean, I just got on with the elder crowd more. And I suppose in a way that meant that I had a lot of fun as well because I could go anywhere with them. Wherever there was a road trip, I could just tag along in the front of the motorbike. So, yeah, no, I think I had a really good time. being the only granddaughter and the only grandchild, I think I had all the attention. So I grew up not actually craving attention, which a lot of people do, perhaps. I actually just grew up feeling quite all right. Yeah, content and no need for attention seeking or competing with anybody, which I think has really, really shaped my personality. And it has helped with the career path that I've taken because it's such a competitive career that if you're insecure or you're not comfortable in your own self, it can be very challenging.
How did the dynamics change once you had other cousins in the family, like other babies started appearing? How did that change your relationship, the adults in the family?
I think, this is an interesting question because I'm going through it right now. My sister, I only have one sibling. So my sister came after 12 years.
That's a long time to be an only child. Like you get used to it.
Yeah, that gives you a background of how even when I had siblings and cousins, it didn't affect me because I was already past my childhood. So competition and people coming in, it really didn't make a difference. But what it does do is that because they're so little, I become a part of the oldie gang.
Taking care of them.
Yeah, I'm not the sister. I'm like the auntie or like the mum. but I do prefer older company because that's just what I've grown accustomed to. And I tend to get on with much, much older people than myself. So a lot of my very, very good friends are in their 60s, for example. But that's because of the kind of Buddhist path that I've taken and because of my career where you meet a lot of senior lawyers and mentors who can help you through. So it's been really helpful that background, that history that I have of getting on with elder people really pushed my ambition further and helped my ambition me achieve it as well, because if I couldn't get on with adults more, then I would have had the amount of help I did to get this far.
That's crazy to think, hey, like the things you're exposed to in your childhood, how that comes into play and builds your strengths or gives you that little push that you need in your adulthood.
Yeah. For me, that's been my biggest strength. Mm. And it comes to me naturally, which I'm really grateful for.
That's good to hear. And how were you in school, like academic wise? You mentioned that your dad was a lawyer, your mom's a teacher. So they're already quite educated, right? In Nepali standards anyways. So how did that impact you as a child and your school life?
That's a really, really interesting question because I wasn't exactly the brightest of the bunch in Nepal because the learning technique and the way we were taught there didn't really suit me. So I worked really hard. But in Nepal, you've got to just be able to kind of rote learn and just be good at doing things quickly. But I found that really challenging. So I used to be doing homework like well into the evening and really tired and just kind of sleeping there because there was too much workload for my kind of level. So I think the reason I flourished so much in the UK is the way that we're taught and the way, you know, you're actually encouraged for creativity and, you know, trying to learn in a different way. Whereas in Nepal, I just didn't quite understand that kind of strict regime. Academia and the family, like you said, has always been very, very, very present. So father's family, mother, and, you know, but Nepal just wasn't the right kind of environment for me to excel as a student. So it only really started getting better when I came to the UK when I was 7.
And you mentioned that you started singing when you were 18 months old. Yeah. Did it ever occur to you to take that as something to pursue, or were you just intent on, no, that's just going to be something that I do in my pastime and studies it is?
Yeah, no, I think it was a bit of both because when I came to the UK, the Nepalese community itself wasn't that big, especially not where I was. I grew up in this little village called Findon in Worthing, which is in West Sussex. It's a really, really isolated kind of place. And I think I was the only Nepalese child again at the time. So very little family.
There's a theme here that I'm sensing.
I know. I'm so glad I haven't turned out weird because of all of that. Well, I might have done. I don't know. But the reason we ended up there was because my father had a restaurant there. So I just grew up there. And at the time, there was only this one organization in London, which was called Yeti, I think. Mm. And they did all the singing and dancing and Nepalese cultural programs. So it was a huge thing and a huge trek for us to come all the way from Worthing to perform in these cultural shows. Mm. So I danced, I think, as my first. And then every other shows I would just perform, and my dad would just take me around just to kind of sing. So he's always been, you know, really, really supportive. I mean, everyone in my family have been really supportive towards singing, and they all actually sing. They just never really took it further.
Oh my God. I've always wondered, for people who actually have good like singing abilities, do they actually sing along like with each other, to each other? Like, you know, do you have those sessions where like everyone just like burst into songs? Or like, I've always imagined that, because obviously we don't have that in my family.
Well, your imagination isn't very far from the truth. It's very, very true. So every time there is a get together or an occasion, my brothers play the guitar, and they've got very, very good voice as well. So they will just burst into things, you know. Especially, I don't know why we're such oldies, but we all always go back to the kind of Nayan Gopal and Gopal, because I think we appreciate music so much that we realize that it's the old that's gold, yeah. Really. So my brothers burst into, like, you know, Sanna Nikoga Lema, like literally, and I'm so it's all these classic songs coming out, and then the father's adding in, you know, my dad sings and the uncle. So the children started off a bit and then they add on. So it's literally musical circles every event.
I love that.
Yeah, it's Hindi, English, Nepali, Newari, whatever.
Everything.
Yeah.
Now, Sneha, you mentioned that one of the themes that have quite presented itself throughout is like you being an only child in different scenarios, right? And even once you move to the UK, being an only like Nepali child, Asian child even.
Yeah.
I guess in the positive, you said that you've never been short of attention, right? Like, and you deal with that really well. But is there any negatives, as in maybe a bit more isolating, or how was that for you growing up?
Okay, you know, that's a very, very thoughtful question, actually, because I've never really thought of it that way, but now that I've mentioned it, I was actually the one that really pushed for my mom to have another child, because I was one of those lonely children that actually wanted a sibling, because a lot of my, you know, a lot of children that are on their own, they actually like the mother-father attention and they're quite happy not having anyone else. But I was so persistent, like, you know, that 12 years later,
yeah,
it happened. So it was always like a real big treat for me. So that's why I've been so, my relationship with my sister is so close because of that, because I almost mothered her as well, in her early years. So the only kind of negative I can see out of that is the expectation. I mean, I've always been, you know, there's never been short of attention, but there's also never been, I've never been short of the expectation and the responsibilities that I've held throughout, even as a child, because there's a certain way that you've got to be as the first child. You've got to take a lot of pride and honor in the way, you know, your family want you to be. And especially now that I'm the eldest of the grandchildren in my mother's side, I'm the kind of role model. So, you know, all my sisters and my cousins are supposed to look up to me. And then from my father's side also, I'm the only kind of, I'm the girl child. So, you know, what is she going to do? How is she going to end up? You know, I was always the protected one, but also the one that had a lot more to live up to. Because I couldn't get things wrong. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so that has been something that I've held with me. And although it's been a strength to be very precise and hardworking and persistent and very, very, you know, high ambitions, it has had a toll on me because it's very tiring and exhausting having all the expectations of every single family member saying, what is she going to do? Right. And why is she out of line at this strange stage of life? Because I've always been quite grumpy and moody as well. Maybe that's why it comes out, because I'm so frustrated with all the attention and the amount of expectation that it just becomes something I don't want. So sometimes I found myself thinking, if I was the kind of youngest child or this kind of child in the middle that nobody cared about, maybe I would have had an easier time, because, you know, not everyone would be so focused on what she gets wrong and what she gets right. So that's definitely been the biggest kind of downside to being the only child theme that I've had. I only realized this like 2 years ago that I'm a perfectionist. So that puts me under a lot of pressure and stress, because if I don't get things perfect, it makes me very uncomfortable. And I'm trying to come out of that, obviously, because it's so unhealthy. And if anybody feels that way, I would say really reflect and think about it, because it's not all about you. And if you get that one tiny step wrong, life is not going to end. The world isn't going to stop. So, I mean, that's the bigger picture that we don't have as, you know, people who work extremely hard and are almost perfectionists, because we feel like everything relies on us. And that's what I'm trying to get out of. And I think that was a product of my childhood and my kind of teenage adulthood, where it was all about me. Yeah.
I definitely think that the perfectionist side of things is like a byproduct, or is like a elder child trait. Like, you know, as you said, like the expectations, and I think it's just the expectations of like your parents and the society. It's also the expectations that you then start putting on yourself.
No, that's the biggest one.
Yeah. And like, that's something that I didn't realize that I did. I always thought, oh, it's expectations of somebody else. And I always tried to put the blame on them. But then it took me a while to realize it's actually not them.
Yeah.
Maybe a certain percentage is them, but the majority, I would say 80 to 90% is just me like on myself.
Yeah.
And that I didn't realize, but it's also conditioned from like when we were kids, right? And like that being the only child for a while. And like, if you show good progress in like a certain subject or something, then like you're going to be a doctor.
Yeah. So, I mean, that brings me to my career path. It wasn't actually forced upon me, because my father, being the barrister in Nepal, was never the one that said, you've got to be a barrister. So it was my mother, I think it was my mother actually, who said, well, you should, you know, pursue, because you're not, I wasn't a bad student ever. So, you should probably consider the law, and that should be, you know, something that you might be very good at. And it's something that I took on and understood that those were the subjects that I was also good at the time. But singing, I don't think I answered your question earlier. It wasn't something that I completely put out of my mind as a career, because my father made such an important decision to take me around and make me perform and do all these things that built me up quite a lot, my personality and my performance skills. And he also said, if you want to be a singer, be a singer, you know. And my mother was also very supportive. I remember she took me to X Factor when I was like 16, and we were just sitting out there for since 6 a.m. waiting for the auditions, and I got through the first and the second, but you've got like 5 or 6 to get through to get to the TV.
That is so cool.
Yeah, so like my entire family was like, okay, she's the singer, she's gonna make it, she's gonna, you know. And so law was never like the actual focus when I was a child.
That's very interesting.
It's, yeah, because nobody said you should be a lawyer, or, you know, you've got to be a lawyer, follow footsteps. No, it was never like that, ever.
So how did you end up pursuing law?
So during my school life, I was just better at English, history, all these analytical subjects and essay writing. So I was interested more in arguments and debate, you know, writing arguments.
Yeah.
And I could only think of that taking me to something like law. So it wasn't 100% at the time when I was 11, 12, but it was just what I was attracted to in terms of the areas that I was good at. And I was never really, I liked maths, but I was never really going to excel and be this mathematician. Science, I was all right at, but I didn't excel in all the other subjects that would have taken me to the law, I mean, as a doctor or something else. Yeah, so that's how it started. And it was also because of my immigration status when I came, I think, because when I didn't have, there was an issue with my immigration status at the beginning, and there was a school trip to France, and I wasn't able to go. So that was another little trigger for me to wonder, why is that then? So, okay. And at that time, my dad did definitely say, well, it's just the law. You need to know about it, you know, and that's what makes things happen. You have to agree. You have to abide by it. You're a citizen. You know, if you're in a country, you can abide by the law.
Mm.
So that was probably where it started. And I thought, okay, well, this makes a huge difference. I should know. So just kind of those little things that happened when I was small, that definitely led me to the direction. But, you know, I never knew the difference between a solicitor and a barrister then. It was just, oh, the law.
I guess for anyone who isn't doing law or doesn't know anyone doing law, they might just all be the same, right? Unless like you're watching Suits or like some shows that like talk about things. Could you just explain to like our listeners as well, like what the difference is between a lawyer, a solicitor, or a barrister?
So I think lawyer is just the term that's used for both, number one. The main difference in the UK, as very few other countries, is the solicitor difference with the barrister. We have different trainings. Although we start from an undergraduate law degree, or we can start from another degree and convert to law, the actual training program, the solicitors go for something called the LPC, and the barristers go for something called the BPTC. They're both 1 year long courses, but the skills and training are completely different, which are suited to the actual pathway that they're going. So as a barrister, you get a lot of advocacy training and a lot of court action. And also barristers practice in something called chambers, and solicitors practice in law firms.
Right.
The real, if we want to be really simple about it, the real difference is the barristers are in court. They deal with the clients in court and the judges.
Yeah.
And solicitors deal with clients and paperwork, a lot of paperwork, which is very, very important to get to court. A lot of cases don't even get to court. So it will be dealt with by the solicitor, and they'll do the paperwork, and they'll hire the right people and sort the legal issue out. It's really important in the UK, and I'm sure other countries too, to not clog up the court, because it's only for serious, serious problems that can't be sorted out before. And for crime, because you can't do anything paperwork really with crime. You've got to be in court. So it's the criminal barristers that are in court all the time, whereas civil barristers and family barristers, there's a lot of paperwork.
Mm. What made you pursue the barrister line instead of the solicitor?
Yeah, I think it's quite simple in terms of my background because of the performing and the advocacy that I was happy doing. Whereas because of all the moves that I've had and all the changes that I've had in my life, I like a lot more action, I guess. I like the advocacy, the drama, and being a singer for so many years and performing.
It's like a court performance, isn't it?
Court is absolutely, you've got to be good at drama. Seriously, you've got to be able to perform. You need that voice projection. You need to know how to think on your feet. So that's where it differs as well with solicitors, because you can actually prepare a case as a solicitor. Mm. You can prepare a case. You can speak to the clients. You can do the research. There's no kind of time limit. Okay. So whereas when you're as a barrister, you can prepare all night. You can prepare as much as you like, but on the day, when you're in front of a judge, if you don't have an answer, you're stuck. So you've got to be able to just say, actually, that or this or that. You've just got to be able to get out of a sticky situation. So it really does separate personalities very quickly. Mm. You know, there are people who like that kind of stress and pressure and being able to just do things on the spot and like huge accomplishment, and there are people who would prefer to take more time, do things slowly and do things correctly. Solicitors don't have to be on the spot that in front of a judge, and it's a lot more scarier when it's a judge because they're a lot more senior and they're looking down on you for an answer when the solicitor may not have told you the answer or the client may not have told you the answer. So you've got to be able to really master this getting out of a sticky situation as a barrister. And no matter how much preparation you do, you might not be, you're never going to be prepared for a case.
Can't even imagine, like, no matter how much preparation you put in, there could always be that surprise element, and you've always got to be able to just think on your feet and be able to respond appropriately, right?
Yeah, exactly that. And you can imagine from everything you've heard about me in this half an hour that goes against every grain of my being. Because there's perfectionism going on, there's, you know, hard work, and it just drives me mental, but it's what actually gets me going. So, you know, if it was an office job or I was going to a firm or a 9-to-5, I would not be so energetic and, you know, ready. But if it's a court case, if they say, okay, go to Brighton tomorrow, or, you know, go somewhere, you know, go to a new place in a new court, I would be ready in a second, because it's that kind of feeling of, yeah, I want to do that, you know.
I guess I can see you in the court as well, like, despite of what you just said, being in court, like the performance aspect, right? Like you being a performer at your heart, court is a performance for you. And also the theme of being the only person and like the attention, like you're not scared of the attention.
Yeah.
Like you're used to getting the attention. So you're just like, this is normal for me.
Yeah.
So it like really just all comes together for you.
Yeah. I just have to deal with the kind of, you know, being able to deal with it and not feeling like I'm missing a trick, because that kind of feeling is always going to push me back, feeling like, oh,
of course,
I didn't do it perfect. So what I'm trying to get myself trained into is to say, it is what it is. Whatever happens will happen. It's the best you can do at that point in time with what information you have. Don't beat yourself up about it. And that's the main advice I would give. People, not just people that want to go into law, but for personal health and well-being, don't beat yourself up about it, you know. And I tend to overthink a lot of things and want things to be right all the time, and that's just a weakness, because there are people that move on, and life, there's a lot more to life than your day-to-day hassles, you know. Just see the bigger picture. And I think the way I became that way, because before I could think this clearly about my mental health and well-being, it's definitely been my Buddhist practice, because I actually go to the monastery and I practice, you know, meditation. So it's not all just you know, gobbledygook, it actually makes a difference. Because before I got into this, before I got into mindfulness and actually the Buddhist way, it didn't make sense to me. You know, I'd need a therapist. I'd need a, you know, a therapist to tell me what's what. But once you actually engage your mind in mindfulness and actually find that thing that really, you know, you understand, for me, it was Buddhism. For other people, it might be different. You just understand that there's more to life than just this kind of rat races that go on. I never really competed in terms of rat races because I came into law a lot later than my contemporaries, because they may have come from undergraduate to bar school and straight into a barrister within, I don't know, 21, 22. But I took a lot of time with my career because I knew it was a big one and I knew that that's what I would be doing all my life. So there's no need to rush. There's no need to say, well, I've got to beat my friend to get there or my enemy. It's just be in your own kind of race, right? Because nobody's going to help you. You know, exactly. At the end of the day, none of your friends are going to like push you up with them. And you've all got different aims and directions in life that you've just got to give yourself enough time. I did a lot of volunteering work and singing Earthquake in Nepal. You know, I did a lot of different things that make me who I am now. It's a lot more sellable, actually. There's a lot more to sell than someone who just came out of education and asked for a job.
Has no experience.
Yeah. So the thing called life experience has been a huge factor for me. And it's, you know, I don't know, it's the unique part of me that people couldn't have experienced. I mean, who would have thought somebody, you know, spent 5 to 6 years just kind of finding themselves in a way and carried so many experience on the way that I would definitely look more, you know, attractive and appealing for someone to take me on than somebody who's just come out of education.
Yeah. This just leads me to my next question really well as well, Sneha. Being the youngest Nepali barrister in the UK, your journey hasn't been very straightforward, right? Like you've taken time to evaluate and assess and not rush into things because you knew what you wanted, but you didn't feel the pressure to get there quickly. If there's one challenge that you could talk to us about in your journey and like maybe a highlight as well, what would they be?
I mean, the one challenge to get into the bar was definitely the lack of familiarity and the people that make me feel like, yes, I can, you know, I can approach this and I can make it, because there aren't enough Nepalese people that are barristers. So I didn't have too many kind of examples to say, well, I'll go to that person and then that person and I'll understand everything. So for me, it's been a huge kind of throughout my journey, it's been a huge push and pressure and challenge trying to find the right people to help me and to recognize that whenever I went to an event or a networking session, to realize that, okay, that person I need to keep in touch with, that person I need to contact. And if I had a lot of, you know, support and a lot of Nepalese people that were barristers who would have just kind of taken me up or, you know, helped me, you know, presented it to me in a silver platter, I wouldn't be as resilient and I wouldn't be as, you know, I need to make my own way out of this, you know, and I need to find the right barrister or the right mentor to say, Sneha, this is what you have to do and this is how things are. So I wouldn't have made the amount of friends. I mean, these mentors and the people that helped me are now my friends, and I would have never been able to have such a rich group of friends if I hadn't gone out there and found my own contacts. So it's very important. They say it's not about who you know, but what you know. But at the end of the day, it's always the kind of right people that you know that will do the guide you. It's not about, you know, getting in from the back door who you know, but now it's really about how you can absorb the right things from the right people. So it is who you know. And so you need to contact and communicate and maintain relationships with the right people who are up there.
You need to be able to put in that hard work as well and not just expect things to happen for you, right?
Yeah. Exactly. So if I had aimed to be the youngest Nepalese female barrister in the UK, I don't think I would have made it because of the pressure and the wrong ambition. You know, the ambition shouldn't be to be different and unique and to break ground. You know, it happens when you polish your craft so much that, you know, you become the best by doing your best, not wanting to be this first, oh my God, you know, honorary, you know, I got an award, but that was a byproduct. You know, the Nepalese community honoring me was a byproduct of my hard work over the years and my the right intentions and the right ambitions I had, which was to be a barrister. It wasn't to be the barrister that would be the, you know, the savior of the Nepalese community or anything like that. So I would advise people to just take it one step at a time, like find out what you want to be, and work hard to become that person that you want to be. Don't take on all this, you know, I want to impress the world view.
I definitely agree that you need to assess on what you want, like you said. I think a lot of times people might be just working towards a goal that's not even theirs.
Exactly.
So they're not reaching their goals because it's not something they truly want.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. So if it's something they truly want, then I think they won't leave any stones unturned.
Yeah.
Like it might be hard. It might be very difficult. And it might take double the time that they thought it would. But if they're truly passionate about something and if it truly means something to them, like they'll find a way to get there.
Yeah. Because it's their journey, you know, and it counts and it matters because it's personal. Exactly. As soon as you start making that external, you're just going to fall in places and you're going to have to restart because we always have to restart. You know, we can't fall and give up. So having to restart on somebody else's dream again, it's just a lot of effort that we don't need in this kind of short lifetime that we have.
Now, Sneha, this brings me to my next question. One of the things I ask all my guests is the definition of what success means to them, right? Because I think this idea of success, we're so driven by it. Like everyone wants to be successful. But what I've realized is by doing this podcast and these interviews is everyone has their own definition of success. And that is just defined by what they have gone through in their journeys and what is really important to them. Mm-hmm. So what does success mean to you now at this stage of your life and your journey?
This is a really cheesy and corny thing to say, but there's been
I love cheesy.
And I think it's always fun to talk about things outside of the law, you know, which has inspired me quite a bit. There's this one movie that even my little sister loves very much, which is Three Idiots. And the one quote that the dialogue that really got to me, and that's really kind of pushed. It's been available and there since I watched that movie. And I always go back to it is pursue excellence. And the success will follow.
Yeah.
So this is exactly what I was trying to say earlier by, you know, don't go after success. Don't go after being the one and only, the biggest, the youngest, the best. You know, that is not what you should be pursuing for success because inevitably there's a lot of downfalls and risks with that. But pursue what you're good at. Pursue it so intentionally and so intensely that you can't fail because you've done everything you could have done to achieve something that you want so much that you're so good at that even if you do fail, you will try again. You know,
it doesn't feel like a failure.
Yeah, it's not a failure because, you know, failure is actually huge blessings because when you fail at something, you work a lot harder to do better. And when I look at all the things that I may have failed in, and of course I've failed in so many, it's always made me come back stronger. And it seems really, really, you know, cliche that, okay, failure is the beginning of this new era and stuff. But believe it, because if you succeed at everything at one go, if it was just a walk in the park, I would never have appreciated it or been grateful for it like I am now with all my failures. added together as, you know, extra bow to my arrow and saying, you know, I made it with all these failures, and with every failure, I became better. And with every failure, I became stronger.
Like, I think failure is such a great way to show you the works of life, you know? And
yeah,
I think when you're younger, you don't really understand that, because our society, our families, they treat failure as something that is so
negative.
Yeah, so negative, and something that you just don't want to be part of, or something you don't want to be.
Mm.
But it is not. Like, it is how you progress in life.
Yeah, yeah. That's the only way you progress in life. We've just got this culture where the fear factor seems to be the driving factor, which is really, really harmful for young minds and children and people that are trying to get somewhere. Because the biggest challenge that we have is ourselves and our fears. You know, people telling you, you can't make it, you can't do that. It doesn't matter. If you think you can, then do it.
Yeah.
One example for that is that statistically in the UK, to be a barrister, it's a joke. Literally, it's a gamble, it's a risk. You spend so much time and money trying to be qualified enough, and then you don't get pupillage, you don't get into good chambers. I don't know the exact statistics, but if you've only got 200 spots to become a barrister and there's like thousands of you competing, you know, what are the odds? You don't have any chance in hell, especially coming from an Asian or, you know, BAME background, not with the same sort of middle class white background that, you know, most of them have with Oxford and Cambridge. You know, all of those, you know, things that society and people get into your head as, you know, that's a fear, you know, you're not going to make it. So what, you know, how have you even considered this? I have literally just said, I don't care. You know, all my life, people giving me all these statistics, you know, trying to just kind of lead me into thinking, oh, maybe it's not possible. Maybe. So that's when I say, don't focus on the noise around you. You know, just be clear that you want to do this, because even if you don't make it, you would have learned so much.
I love that you turn every challenge into a highlight, Sneha.
Yeah, no, I think it's so necessary. I think everyone needs to be able to do that. Everyone needs to practice doing that.
100%. Well, Sneha, thank you so much for your time. It's been lovely getting to know your journey and just having this chat with you. It's just made my weekend. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you, finally.
Yeah, we do.
As always, if you enjoy these conversations as much as I do, please share with your friends and family. If you'd like to share your feedback, you can reach us on Instagram at hamro.yatra or email askhamroyatra@gmail.com. I love hearing from you, so keep them coming.